You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, being a caretaker for a loved one can be a big responsibility, both mentally and financially, in normal times. And it can be even harder during the pandemic. We'll get advice from a caregiving expert. Now, Democratic impeachment managers have finished making their case against President Trump on charges of inciting the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. After spending yesterday walking through the timeline of events from that day, Democrats focused today on Trump's past remarks about political violence and his actions during and after January 6th. Here's a listen to Representative Ted Lieu of California speaking earlier today.
Now, President Trump would have his base and the world believe that his conduct was totally appropriate. It is important to impeach that falsehood, to make clear to his supporters and everyone watching that what Donald Trump did was not acceptable.
After today, former Trump's defense team will start to present their case. Trump's chances of being acquitted appear high. Earlier this week, only six Republican senators voted that even holding the impeachment trial from a former president was constitutional. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been watching the trial in the Senate, what has stood out to you? Has what you've seen changed your feelings about what happened at the Capitol? Do you think President Trump should be convicted of inciting the attack? Or do you think that there's no direct connection, or that it is, as many Republican senators have argued, unconstitutional to impeach the president now that he's out of office? And what does it all mean for the future of our politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Maurice Shepard is an instructor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, what has stuck out to you about the case that the Democratic impeachment managers presented over the last couple of days?
Just focusing just on the presentation, they were very different in terms between the House managers and the president's defense. The House managers were focused. The president's defense team was unfocused. House managers provided details. That's something that the president's defense team lacked. And the House managers did a good job, I think, in terms of telling a story, storytelling, whereas the president's defense team, I think, was a little too informal, and that really hurt their ability to get their message through.
We'll hear more from that team tomorrow, and it looks like maybe just tomorrow. They have up to 16 hours. I've heard reporting that they're just going to take about half of that, so potentially only tomorrow. All that said, do you think that there are persuadable senators really on either side of this story at this point?
I think there are. I do not think that former President Trump will be convicted to get conviction in the Senate impeachment trial. There needs to be two-thirds, a supermajority. I don't think that, and that would mean 17 Republican senators voting with the Democrats. I don't think that they will achieve that. But I think there are some Republican senators that are leaning in that direction for a number of reasons. One would be just in terms of, again, they may share some of the constitutional issues that the Democrats are bringing forward, the House managers, an issue of party legitimacy. Again, they know that their party, it's not just ex-former President Trump that's being looked at here. And also for some of those Republicans, a personal responsibility. They may feel as an elected official, it is their responsibility to look at the facts in the case.
I want to give a listen to one of the senators. So I think you were likely just talking about Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Reacting here to the presentation and the videos and timelines that she saw yesterday, here's a listen.
I'm angry, I'm disturbed, I'm sad. As you say, we're reliving this. We lived it once, and that was awful. And we're now reliving it with a more comprehensive timeline.
And that's been something that stuck out, I think, to a lot of people, including some Republican senators, Maurice, who might vote on either side. The traumatic events of January 6th, and with the timeline as presented by the House impeachment managers, the fact that there were places where senators, the vice president, members of Congress were within feet or minutes of running across these rioters who had just proven willing to attack police officers. Can you talk about the impact of just seeing these videos?
Sure. Yeah. The video that was introduced was striking a number of points. One, it did for the House managers, they did try to make the link between former President Trump's language, his speeches, and the Capitol rioters. Second, the video that was introduced also highlighted how organized the Capitol rioters were, sort of pre-riot and also during the riot. It showed that there was some military training there, at least individuals in the crowd that were directing that had some military training. And also the depth and the intensity of the Capitol rioters. That was striking and unsettling. I think that also highlights what may be sort of in the longer scope of things, may highlight that this country, that the United States, we have an issue in terms of political socialization, that for many, it was caught on tape, unfiltered in many cases, of a deep lack of trust in the formal institutions of government.
Talking to Maurice Shepard, instructor of political science at Madison College, looking at the latest in the ongoing impeachment trial of former President Trump in the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Maurice, we've heard from Senator Ted Cruz yesterday saying Democrats hadn't proved that Trump's comments meet the legal definition of incitement. Democratic House managers today following that up in some ways, making the case that impeachment is not a criminal trial. It is a political trial. And they're talking about holding the president, the former president, to his oath of office. Is there a different standard that you might see in a criminal trial for, say, incitement to violence versus an impeachment of a president on the same cause?
Yes. For Senator Cruz, he's absolutely right in terms of, once again, the impeachment process. It is a political process. It's not the same as a criminal or civil trial. A major difference here is that in the Senate impeachment trial, the senators sit as both judge and jury. You would not have that in the regular sort of judicial proceeding. The other key point here is the presiding officer. You don't have necessarily a judge sort of sitting there that can make, that has true authority in the Senate impeachment trial, the presiding officer. Usually when if a president is, or a vice president is undergoing, once again, impeachment, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court would be the presiding officer. Because Donald Trump is now an ex-president, we now have instead the president pro tem of the Senate, Senator Patrick Leahy. So that's very different. And in that position, Senator Leahy doesn't have a lot of power or authority. The only area that the literature highlights where the authority in the Senate impeachment trial has power will be in terms of questions about evidence. Anything beyond that, the presiding officer really has very little, if any, authority.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Judy is with us in Glidden. Judy, hi.
Hi there. I guess I would just like to make a comment, not only to our state senator, Tammy Baldwin, and Senator Ron Johnson, but to remind them they were elected to preserve our democracy. And everything that we have heard, if they do not vote to convict Trump, are they an American, and is this America? And that's all I have to say.
Judy, thanks a lot for the call. Judy, echoing what we've heard from some of the Democratic House impeachment managers there, saying this is what happened in the Capitol was un-American, saying that action is needed here to preserve democracy. Can you talk about that side of the argument from the House managers, Maurice?
Sure. For the House managers, their position is, and as you noted earlier, there was a vote and it was determined that that it is constitutional for an ex-president to undergo an impeachment trial in the Senate. So the constitutionality in that sense has been settled. But for the House managers, the issues that they're looking at will be one in terms of adherence to the Constitution. They believe that a high crime and misdemeanor has been committed in former President Trump's incitement of insurrection. they also would make the argument that, once again, he needs to be tried in the Senate impeachment trial for Democratic accountability, that his actions upset the public good and threaten the formal institutions of government. In particular, one could argue overturning the results, or trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, and also, again, the incitement to insurrection that happened at the Capitol on January 6th.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Maurice Shepard from Madison College, political scientist there, and we're talking about the ongoing impeachment trial of former President Trump as Democrats concluded making their case today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. Senate should vote to convict President Trump on the charge of inciting the attack on the U.S. Capitol? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maurice Shepard, political science instructor at Madison College, looking at the latest in former President Trump's impeachment trial. We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hello.
Good afternoon, folks. I guess my biggest thing is, wouldn't it be far better to former President Trump on trial in front of a judge and a jury? Because what is, even if they succeed in the impeachment trial, what is going to be his punishment? He needs to be punished. His punishment needs to fit the crimes for which he is committed.
Pat, thanks for the call. A couple separate threads there, Maurice. First of all, there is the thought that, okay, after you convict, you can also, and this is in the Constitution, you can also bar someone from running for future office. So that is at least one potential consequence if there are enough senators to convict. Do I have that right?
Yes. There's some issue in terms of, you know, that the additional punishment beyond, again, sort of losing the office, in terms of barring that person from holding federal office, it's holding federal office or holding any federal position of honor in that sort. There's some discussion about, you know, is that automatic? Some would say that it isn't. Some would argue that it is. There can also be additional punishments in terms of reducing or even removing some of the benefits that an ex-president may have. Again, former presidents, they receive a number of benefits in terms of security and other sort of, benefits of that sort. Pat makes a point in terms of, for former President Trump, some may feel that may not be punishment enough. A couple other things that could take place. One, and this happened with the Bill Clinton impeachment from 1999. Then President Bill Clinton was acquitted of, once again, a number of impeachment charges against him. But after there was an attempt to censure him in the Senate, that censure failed. All you need is a simple majority. It failed. Now, the same thing could happen for former President Trump, that even if he is acquitted on the single charge, the Senate could vote and a majority could vote to censure him. The other thing, as Pat mentioned, though, is in terms of civil action, former President Trump, citizen Donald Trump, faces a number of, once again, civil actions, not related to the events of January 6th, but there are other actions, civil actions that will be coming sort of his way from the state of New York and also more recently from Georgia, Fulton County, I believe, as it relates to, again, his attempt to force some change in terms of the election results from the 2020 presidential election.
I think Pat was suggesting maybe criminal charges related to January 6th, and it seems hard to bring criminal charges against a president for things they did while president. It's kind of a tall bar to clear at least. Is that right, Maurice?
Well, and that's one of the criticisms. That's a criticism that has been made of the House managers, that maybe the impeachment charge did not go far enough, that instead they've taken a more sort of a umbrella approach to it by using the incitement of of insurrection to sort of capture all of that. And that may actually be a point that the president's defense team may bring up, that if that is the case, then that should have been one of the a separate impeachment charge, and it's not there.
Let's go back to our callers now. Andrea is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Andrea, hi.
Hi. There seem to me to be two dangerous precedents in this trial. One is trying someone who is no longer in office. I know we've heard that argument. I feel it's valid. And the second one is a little more concerning, and that is the freedom of speech, First Amendment. We're a democracy. We live by those amendments. I think that we are putting both those things in jeopardy. That's it.
Andrea, thanks for the call. That second point, the president's attorneys have made that argument. You can't charge him for free speech. The House manager saying, well, hold on, free speech doesn't include incitement to violence. Can you talk about that that angle of the argument, Maurice?
Sure. And Andrea is correct that, again, the primary argument that's been made is that it's unconstitutional to try an ex-president. And then after that would come, as she as correctly pointed out, the protection of speech. There can be, once again, protection of freedom of speech, but also there can be protection of political speech on both of those issues. It's very unsettled. And this is where the House managers have tried to make sort of the difference here, that that as president of the United States, Donald Trump holds a unique position in society and also in our political system. And quite frankly, this is an ongoing issue. The literature and research on not just protection of, once again, freedom of speech, but particularly when you get into political speech, that gets very tricky. And I think what you will see from the president's defense team coming up very shortly is that they will use samples of Democrats in some of their speech that may be unpleasant, that may be challenging to some, and they will make, and the president's defense team will make the argument that sort of, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, that if these, once again, Democrats have made these also sort of inflammatory speeches, and we did not, once again, censure or try to impeach them, whatever the case may be, that the president should not be held to a different or a higher standard.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Maurice Shepard from Madison College, political scientist there, looking at the latest in the impeachment proceedings. Back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Mount Morris. Ed, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I believe ex-President Trump should be impeached. And if I'm not mistaken, everyone in the Capitol has taken the same oath that he did. So if they do not convict him, are they not held to the same standard of not protecting the Constitution?
Ed, thanks a lot for the call. There's no consequence, I think, Maurice, for a senator voting for or against impeachment, as Ed is bringing up.
Well, and Ed makes a good point. Yes, there are no consequence. There are no formal consequences,
right.
Let's put it that way.
Good clarification.
Now,
thank you.
Now there may be political consequences. Mm-hmm. And again, I go back to what we started with in this discussion, is that impeachment is a political process. That means that it's going to be ugly and it takes other things into consideration. Just in terms of politics, and this, again, this may be unpleasant, but for Democrats, but in particularly for Republicans, they are looking forward beyond this trial to the 2022 midterm elections and the 2024 presidential election cycle. And they have to begin to sort of position themselves individually and also as a party. What is the party? What is the Republican Party? What does it stand for? Where is it going? Are they the party of Lincoln or are they the party of Trump? So Ed is absolutely right about that. But again, politics, it is a political process and politics is part of the process.
Thanks for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Maurice, do you expect to see people try to clarify some of the questions about the presidency that President Trump tested, whatever you think of what he did? I mean, the Mueller report said, here's evidence related to obstruction of justice, but you can't really criminal charge. So we're going to leave that open. The president was expected to maybe issue a self-pardon, raising questions. Can a president do that? Do you think some of the things we've taken for granted as sort of a custom or tradition might get hammered out in the law in the years to come?
My students are tired of hearing me say this, but the U.S. president over time, the office of the president did not start off, again, for the American founders. They did not envision a president as powerful as we have today. The presidency, the institution of the president, has grown in power over time, in some cases because presidents have once again taken that power on. But also part of it is that the legislature has, again, granted some of the authority to the president in order to get things done. The presidency is the branch of the executive is the branch of government that actually executes, once again, the powers of government and that sort. I think it's something that American citizens have to think about and consider how much power, how much authority does a president actually have? And it may call for a constitutional amendment at some point. There are some that argue that we've enshrined the Constitution as this noble document that's beyond, updating. Some would argue that as Americans, what we probably need to do is go back and take a hard look at the Constitution and come to the realization that there may be some areas where some updating needs to take place. In this case, it would involve, again, the executive branch and the powers of the president.
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Maurice Shepard, instructor of political science at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about the latest in the U.S. Senate trial of former President Trump. Coming up, we'll talk to a family and caregiving expert about how the pandemic has impacted the lives of people caring for elderly family members, either in their own homes or, in some cases, from afar. We'll get advice. You could share your experiences as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, writers of color are looking to change the expectations made of them and their work, or are making space for tales that are not entirely rooted in trauma. But you'll find out what happens when they do, plus the latest on COVID-19 vaccines for kids. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, according to AARP, nearly half of family caregivers are reporting that their responsibilities have increased since the start of the pandemic. And over the past year, many people have become caregivers for the first time, in many cases related to COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you been a caregiver for a loved one in the past or maybe right now? Have you become one since the pandemic began? What kind of things have changed with all the changes that came with the pandemic? What are the hardest things? Have you been able to find moments of joy along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amy Goyer is a family and caregiving expert for AARP and moderates their Family Caregivers Discussion Group on Facebook. She's the author of several books, including AARP's Juggling Life, Work, and Caregiving. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I know this is an issue that's close to your heart. You're in touch with a lot of people who are doing caregiving right now. You've been a caregiver, of course, yourself. What has changed during the pandemic? What kind of things are you hearing from people?
You know, one of the things I'm hearing is that caregivers are even more isolated than they were before, and their loved ones are. So that's, you know, one of the fallout from the pandemic has been true for everyone. And family caregivers have a history of already being isolated because your life gets smaller. You know, you're focused on taking care of your loved ones, maybe working, your family, and that isolation now is really magnified, which is negative for the health of the caregivers as well as for their care recipients. You know, it's as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's worse than obesity on our health.
have people had to change, maybe become more caregivers for the same person they would have been? I think, you know, there might be, well, I check in on a parent or whoever every now and then. Have you seen people making the decision like, we're going to need to pod together full time now?
Yes. In fact, some people who really weren't considering themselves caregivers before kind of thrust into a caregiving situation due to the pandemic, because their loved ones who were, you know, going, doing their grocery shopping themselves and things before, now they don't want them to do that. So they may be doing all of the errands for their loved ones, taking them to doctor's appointments, keeping more of an eye on them, helping them with emotional support. And there are families who, due to the pandemic, have decided to, you know, not just pod together, but actually live together. And we have people who've brought their loved ones into their home to live together.
I know in some cases, people might be able to afford to hire some help with the caregiving, or might be, get some public or other support to help them do that. But how much has the pandemic itself affected that, the willingness to bring people into your house, the willingness of people to come into your house?
Right. It's a scary thing right now. And so we have people who've been caregiving at home and, you know, maybe had a great system set up where they had some paid caregiver help. Maybe they had help coming in from the VA or the Area Agency on Aging. And now they're afraid to have anyone come in the home. So I hear from a lot of caregivers who are kind of going it alone more than they were before. The respite programs, you know, we have a lot that are still willing to come into the home, but the issue is, are the caregivers willing to allow people to come in the home? So we just really urge people to think about the safety precautions and balance that with the mental health of the caregiver and the actual care needs of your loved ones.
What kind of advice would you give people who are feeling like, you know, with this double whammy, caregiving and the pandemic, they're at the wit's end of their wit's end? What kind of things would you suggest to them to get started on getting a grasp on this?
You know, the first thing to do is to really fully evaluate, is there a way to get more help? And it might mean that family members who live at a distance but are able to drive, maybe they are going to come in and stay with the loved ones sometimes and give you a break. In some cases, families have chosen to go ahead and have some home health aides or have some paid caregivers come into the home to get those breaks. If your choice is to not do that, then you need to look at the best ways you can to fill yourself up. You know, you give a lot when you're caregiving, and it's like you give it all away, and you cannot run on empty. That's something I learned when I was in the deepest throes of caregiving. So find ways to fill yourself up. And that might be that you give yourself a break and you're going to do the dishes in the morning, or you're going to really make a good cup of coffee and sit and watch a movie with your loved one, or you're going to get on Facebook. AARP has a wonderful Facebook family caregivers discussion group that I moderate. And I think a lot of caregivers are hopping in there when they have time to kind of be able to vent and get some support and connect with the outside world.
And yeah, that notion that knowing you're not alone, I think that might mean something in and of itself, right? Finding those connections with other people in similar situations.
Yes, I hear it over and over again, especially in that Facebook group, that they say, you know, I really thought I was the only one doing this. And, you know, and part of that is because we don't think of ourselves as caregivers. We're just sons and daughters and spouses and nieces and nephews who are just taking care of somebody who needs it in our family. But the fact is that you are a caregiver and there are others doing similar things, and just kind of validating like, oh, somebody else is doing this and they found a solution for this problem, you know, and you can post that and then get a lot of great input on how to problem solve.
We're talking to Amy Goyer, family and caregiving expert for AARP. She moderates what she was just talking about, the Family Caregivers Discussion Group on Facebook. She is giving advice for people who are caregiving for family members or others during the pandemic. And you can join in maybe to share your experience, maybe with a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Robert is with us in Green Bay. Robert, hello.
Hi, good evening. The reason why I'm calling is that I am an in-home caregiver to my daughter through the pandemic last summer. She turned 18. She has missed out on a lot of things. She's still attending school because she goes to a special education school. and you just imagine all the other events, and like you had mentioned, respite is not available. So I had taken on many different things, wore many different hats, being a caregiver for her. And from doing so, the agency that we worked through sent us a paper that said you are eligible to receive your COVID-19 vaccine. Anyone who I've told about this, even when I went to set the appointment, they've asked me, are you over 65? No, I'm not, but, and then I explained what I just told you. And it seems like I got nothing but, like, ridicule. Like, how are you getting your vaccine first? What are you doing? You're not an essential worker. I feel that I am. Your opinion, please.
Robert, thanks for the call. There's an issue going on now, Amy, with vaccines. Apparently, for a caregiver, Robert is eligible. I don't, your thoughts? I assume you don't think he should feel bad about this. He is providing a service there.
No, I do not think he should feel bad about that. This is a huge issue that I've been hearing about from caregivers from long before the vaccine was even available, because everyone was thinking about this. You know, the fact is, you know, my loved one, I'm with my loved one all the time, and I have to go to the grocery store. I could bring that home to them. You know, how are we protecting them? But you're not really protecting them if you're not protecting their caregivers. So people have been asking these questions. My best advice is to contact your local health department and ask, can caregivers receive priority? I've heard a wide variety of stories of people who, when they take their loved ones to get their vaccines, that sometimes they are able to then get their vaccine at the same time, because it's pretty really quite obvious that they're a caregiver. There are some states who have actually made a policy of that you can do that. So if he received an official letter from an official agency saying, you are eligible to get your vaccine because you're in this caregiving situation, then I would say accept it. Don't feel bad about it. I think that, you know, that agency is really thinking wisely about how to best protect vulnerable populations.
Thanks for the call, Robert, at 800-642-1234. And Amy, Robert brings up another point. A lot of times when I think of a family caregiver, probably a lot of people think this, you're thinking of taking care of a senior, maybe an aging parent. That is not always the case, though, right?
Right. You know, family caregivers take care of people of all ages. And we have, we may have loved ones who are our children who have disabilities and who are, you know, growing up as well. Our adults, we have many people who are taking care of veterans who have been injured in the service and who are really quite young. So there, you know, someone might have a brain injury from a car accident. So the people are caregivers all ages. We know that, you know, there are larger numbers caring for older adults, but there certainly are significant numbers who are caring for younger people.
We're talking to Amy Goyer, a family and caregiving expert for AARP. She's the author of books, including AARP's Juggling Life, Work, and Caregiving. We're talking about the role of family caregivers during the pandemic and how that's raised new challenges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you right now? What has your caregiving experience been like in the last year? If you were a caregiver in the past, what advice would you give to people doing this right now? And how has the pandemic changed things? Do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about family caregivers during COVID-19. Amy Goyer is with us, family and caregiving expert for AARP, author of books including AARP's Juggling Life, Work, and Caregiving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a family caregiver now? How has the pandemic changed things? Have you found solutions, ways to make things work better, maybe less stressful? Or do you need that suggestion? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Cazenovia. Kathy, hi.
Hi. My question is, are there resources to try to help other family members understand how difficult it is for those of us who are the family caregivers? My father has Alzheimer's. He's in memory care right now, but for 5 years, I was a main caregiver, as well as I do caregiving as my regular job too. And my family and I just could not seem to understand how difficult it was. Are there resources out there to help educate those who aren't doing the most of the hard work?
Kathy, thank you so much for sharing that. Amy, is there something that somebody in the position Kathy was in can point to for those family members who might not get how much work she's doing?
Right, Kathy, my heart goes out to you. You know, my dad had Alzheimer's also, and he lived with me for 6 years. So I've been through this caregiving situation, as you say. And it is one of the most difficult things that I hear from families is about siblings, especially, you know, it's the most common scenario of other family members who don't really understand what's needed and don't understand how difficult it can be. AARP has a wonderful website, aarp.org/caregiving, where we have resources there and articles and things to help people understand what caregivers are facing. And we also have a lot of videos. I think sometimes the videos are what really get across to people. We've also been working with the Ad Council for many years and trying to get images out and get people to understand and raise awareness about the challenges of family caregiving and the resources that are out there for them. A lot of families actually go into mediation, and they get a trained family mediator who can sit down with them and help family members work out arrangements so that the care is more shared and help other family members understand what one family member is going through. So that's another option that you can look into.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kathy. And Amy, for that family member, and now with COVID, you know, maybe there was that sympathetic family member who could come and help out, and now they can't travel or don't feel comfortable traveling. Are there ways to still support remotely the Kathy in your family?
Very good question. You know, I think that it's actually really agonizing for a lot of family members who are staying away. And there's sometimes a family will say, okay, we're going to choose one person who interacts with mom and dad. That doesn't mean everybody else is off scot-free. Even if you're at a distance, you can help manage finances. You can do that almost all online now. You can help do research and find things. You can order groceries and have them delivered. You can do other kinds of online shopping and problem solving and trying to figure out, oh, you know, we're having a problem with incontinence. What are the supplies that are available? What's something new we can do with this? You can make doctor's appointments. You can even sit in on doctor's appointments now, especially if they're on, you know, a Zoom, if they're video appointments. And so there are many ways to be involved. But most importantly, remember that if you've got a family member who is really, you know, carrying the bulk of the responsibilities and the tasks for caregiving, give them reinforcement. Tell them how much you appreciate them. Tell them you see what they're doing. You know, sometimes caregivers just want to be acknowledged. And it's not they don't want to do what they're doing. It's just that they want somebody to appreciate it and understand. You can send flowers and send a card. And I remember one time my sister surprised me with chocolate-covered strawberries and just a note that said, thank you for what you're doing. And that meant the world to me. I still have that note.
Talking to Amy Goyer from AARP, looking at caregiving for a family member, especially during the pandemic, the new challenges that can raise. Still time for your experiences and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amy, this is an act of love, of course, the caregiving. These are people who presumably care about each other coming in. But there's a lot of work. People are cooped up. Even if you're used to going out for a walk, it's, you know, we're occasionally kissing positive temperatures in Wisconsin these days. You're cooped up together. How do you make sure to maintain that friendly and loving relationship in a stressful time when you're cooped up together like this?
It's really a good point. If you're living with the people that you're taking care of, any ways that you can have alone time, you know, any way that you can possibly do that, whether it's setting up a television in their bedroom so that they can, you know, have a little time watching what they want, you can watch what you want. One of the things I hear a lot from caregivers is mom has to have the TV on so loud and it's driving me insane. And so, you know, what I did with my dad was I got him special TV headphones so that he could listen to it at the volume that worked for him, and I could have the TV in the room on at a normal volume for me. And, you know, I can't tell you how many headaches that saved me. So try to look at really practical things like that to try and manage the issues. again, if there's any way to get a break, do so, you know, even if it's once a month where you have a day that you're not with that person or caring for them, great. One of the things that a lot of people do is when it's not too snowy or icy, is get in the car and go for a drive. You know, even if you don't get out of the car and go anywhere, you're out of the house and it's a change of pace, and you maybe, you know, pick up some food or you listen to music in the car. It's just a change of scenery can really be helpful too.
And that seems like the sort of thing that the advice sharing, like on your Facebook chat, would be helpful. And something you wouldn't necessarily come up with when you're in the middle of stuff.
Exactly. When you're in that situation, you're just desperate. And sometimes you really are in burnout. And it's really hard to ask for help when you're in that situation. And I find that being able to just go post something on an online page, that's something some people have enough energy to do. And then they get, 100 responses back with suggestions. And that's like, wow, like you said before, I'm not alone, you know? It takes some effort to do that. But I do really urge people, if you find that you're seeing the red flags of stress and burnout, you know, you can get online counseling now. Almost all of the health plans will cover some type of a system for online counseling and therapy. There are support groups that are meeting online or on the telephone for caregivers. You can contact your local area agency on aging and ask what caregiver support is out there for me.
Let's bring on another caller now. Pam is with us in Appleton. Pam, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My mom, who is 92 and now since New Year's Eve, lives in a skilled nursing facility with an excellent dementia program. But she had been living with my family for 5 years. She was diagnosed with mixed dementia, vascular and Alzheimer's. And I have one sibling who lives in New Jersey. My kids were in high school, college, and now adults. And my husband was working. I was working. And I was sole responsibility for my mom. And as the years went by and her needs increased, it just got to be so difficult that I took early retirement from my job back at the end of 2019, and then COVID hit. And she fell last year and broke both of her hips. Last year was just so, so difficult. We had outside caregivers, but then, you know, when COVID in March, when things just really got terrible with COVID, I furloughed them because I didn't want them coming in, you know, because they'd been other places and I couldn't control where they'd been. So I was sole caregiver, and it was very, very difficult. Wow. It really took a toll on me, physically and emotionally. You know, because you're not just seeing the someone you love dearly just fade away from dementia or you know, other serious illness, but then you're having to, you know, focus on.
Pam, I'm gonna have to jump in. We're just about out of time. I'm glad that your mom is in a good care center now. Leave us, Amy, with a little bit of inspiration for people going through what Pam went through, just in our last 30 seconds, please.
Well, I just want everyone to realize that now is the time to kind of go back to the basics. Take it one day at a time, sometimes every 10 minutes at a time. I can get through these next 10 minutes, right? And think about the basic things, you know, take some deep breaths, do some yoga or some seated things. Mindfulness exercises actually really lower the stress a lot. There's lots of studies on this. And I know that it helped me a lot to kind of try and stay in the here and now as my mind, you know, I was listening to this last caller and, you know, it goes on and on and on. And that's, I know that feeling because I've been there myself. And the thing that got me through is realizing I'm not going to be perfect. The waves are going to come along and knock me down, and mom's going to break a hip, and there things are going to happen, and I'm going to get back up. And I can be resilient. I can be there and do the best I can. And that is success. So just know that you are doing your best, and we acknowledge you and we thank you for all that you're doing for your loved ones.
Best to you and your mom, Pam. And Amy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Amy Goyer is a family and caregiving expert for AARP and moderates their Family Caregivers Discussion Group on Facebook. She's the author of books including AARP's Juggling Life, Work, and Caregiving. Tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at Wisconsin's laws on emergency detention for people in the midst of a mental health crisis. And up next on Central Time, more women are serving in the Wisconsin State Legislature than ever before. It's happening in other states, too. We'll look at those trends. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.